Just a reminder, today's conference is being recorded.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Farrell, LeBron & Martell's presentation on tech and IP-driven company restarts. My name is Dean Gloucester. I'm a partner here, and I lead our insolvency, restructuring, and creditors' rights group. When the economy is good, I represent a lot of tech companies, early-stage companies, IP-driven companies, on the sort of the upside. When the economy is bad, I end up doing a lot of restructuring.
Joining conference.
Some workout, relaunches, those kinds of things. And
joining conference.
That is the primary focus of my practice for the last couple of years. I'm joined on the panel by Matt Lewis, who is the head of our corporate and transactional group and also a partner. And Matt, why don't you start us out by explaining our agenda?
Okay, and just to add to Dean's resume, in my case, I deal with money and good times getting money and in bad times trying to collect it or preserve it. So these are issues that are obviously pretty germane to the topic at hand. So what we were going to talk about today is, first of all, why technology and IP companies are different and why that difference makes for a more difficult situation in a credit-constrained or capital-constrained economy like we're currently facing. We're going to discuss how to keep the business going and lengthening the runway before disaster or before takeoff. You put in place a plan to gain access to new capital. Some last money in financing techniques. Assuming you've accessed capital, how to restart, reboot, reanimate, and relaunch the business without losing too much momentum. Or in the alternative, or as part of that plan, how to purchase, sell, or merge a distressed company with another company in order to realize the value that's been created. And finally, the personal note, how to avoid personal liability, including director and officer liability, and how not to give in to some of the temptations that exist in this environment.
And there are some characteristics of IP-driven and technology companies that come to bear in a money-constrained environment. Because these companies typically scale well, there's often a huge upside. At the same time, it's the skills and the know-how of individual employees and often very technically skilled individual employees who are often a critical asset, but those are assets that are free to leave the business and, in fact, go home every night. They are often financed and owned through the VC and angel model of preferred stock for outside investors, common stock for founders and principals, and options for key employees and directors, which means that there are kind of different incentives for different people at different levels of the capital structure.
So the characteristics that we talked about, that Dean just mentioned for IP and tech companies, leads to the situation where lack of capital, lack of a constrained money environment makes things very difficult for them. And of the list that I'm about to present, I'd say the first and the last are the ones that really are worth focusing on. As Dean mentioned, the primary asset of an intellectual property-based company is, in fact, its people. They are mobile by nature, they are ambitious by nature, and they are looking for the right opportunity. If they don't see it, they will leave. The hard assets, on the other hand, except for certain limited manufacturing-based IP or tech companies, are virtually worthless. As we saw in the aftermath of the dot-com boom, there's really not much of a market for used laptops or used volleyball court equipment. Also, in the market, technology and IP companies, they need momentum. They need to grow. They need to be seen as have the buzz of being at the leading edge. They need to be defining their market, not following their market, if they're going to realize their true potential. Next, the capital structure in most tech companies.
Joining conference.
Tends to make it particularly difficult to find the last dollars that one needs in a difficult environment. Finally, of course, and related to all of this,
joining conference
experience in financial difficulties is a huge one, which is far down the curve and still needs continued funding for its research and development.
So, Matt, why don't you talk about some of the techniques for lengthening the runway when there isn't enough cash?
Okay. And first of all, I would remark that lengthening the runway needs to be done in conjunction with an overall plan for recovery. It is not a temptation just to kick that, the can down the road and to avoid some of the hard decisions we're about to talk about in the next couple of slides. First, of course, is simply to conserve cash. One way to do that is to create deferred compensation agreements with your employees, particularly your exempt employees. Now, there are rules around that that we will discuss, but again, you know, most of your expense tends to be with employees, and that's the first place to look. You are still subject to wage and hour laws, though, so you do need to be careful. Be careful about having realistic cash flow projections. You need to know where the cash is going to be needed when. Just doing last-minute layoffs is not a way to save cash because there's often significant payouts associated with them. You can go virtual. That is, kind of crawl into your hole, become a spore company, and hope that things turn around, although, as we'll remark later, there's some significant issues with that, and it often doesn't work. Finally, as an overall message, we would say that be realistic. All right, look ahead. Don't fool yourself. Have realistic expectations. Have realistic projections. Know when you're going to need the cash and act accordingly.
So let's talk about the deferred comp and stay pay agreements. And let's start with the deferred compensation agreement for a management or other exempt employee. And when I say an exempt employee, it's someone who isn't required to be paid minimum wage according to the wages and hours laws and is an exempt employee for purposes of the wages and hours law. This is particularly common with the startup, with the early stage company, where you've got a small group of people, all of whom are really, or most of whom are
joining
really
conference,
a management or a technical team. One of the things that you can do when you're almost out of money to lengthen that runway is to provide an agreement with each of these executives and technical employees that reduces their salary to the minimum necessary to stay an exempt employee in California, which is a number that's a bit north of $30,000 a year. And then there's typically some sort of agreement that says, look, if you stay around and we close this funding round or we close the sale of the company or we launch our product or we do X or Y or Z, then you will get a bonus which is calculated based upon, you know, whatever the formula is, or you will get this sort of deferred compensation. There are some problem areas. The first is if your guy or gal needs to pay a mortgage, they have minimum cash flow needs and there's a limit to how long they can work for $30,000 living in the Bay Area. You do have to make sure that you're dealing with exempt employees, and then there are some tricky tax issues if you're pushing deferred compensation into a next taxable year.
Dean, who would qualify as an exempt employee?
Well, most of the people who are management, most of the people who are engineers, most of the people who are technical employees are exempt employees. Your receptionist answering the phone is likely not an exempt employee. And, you know, companies have learned the hard way. You can't just make someone an exempt employee by calling them, you know, vice president in charge of answering the phone. There's a separate kind of agreement, which is really a stay pay agreement. And this is trying to align incentives as you manage toward a salvage sale. Typically for IP-driven and technology companies that intend to grow toward an IPO or an acquisition, a substantial incentive for the people who are working in the business is their stock option or their, you know, inexpensive stock.
No, it doesn't.
Hey, anyone who's on the phone, please hit mute so we're not picking up your background conversation. Thanks. So on a stay pay agreement, what you essentially do is you say, we understand that the common stock and the stock options may be out of the money, and here we've raised, you know, $30 million from the outside in the form of preferred stock with a liquidation preference. We're now managing towards some salvage sale. We think that we can get $12 million for this company if we sort of manage it toward this sale. In that scenario, typically what people do is sit down with the management team, the key employees, and say, look, if you stay and manage toward a salvage sale and we arrive at that salvage sale, then you'll get, we, the preferred shareholders, will give up a portion of the compensation and allow you to share in that as long as we reach some sort of hurdle. There are all kinds of issues in negotiating those. You're better off doing them earlier rather than later, and there's typically some sort of hurdle. People say, well, look, we have to get at least X amount of money, and then we share it this way. There are timing issues about that, but the basic goal is to try to use that agreement to align the incentives of the party to stick around and to maximize the value for the stakeholders who are in the money.
Cash flow management is a combination of finance and psychology, at least in my view. There are some very common traps that we find people place themselves in. One is that they are unrealistic. Either they are unrealistically optimistic about what their cash flow needs are, and therefore find themselves quickly behind and unable to meet their commitments and the promises they've made, or they are unrealistically pessimistic, in which case they panic and make decisions without planning for them, which can expose them often to personal liability. Or finally, they only view the world through a single option mindset, and so that they don't have fallback positions. All these things are very, very dangerous for obvious reasons. So, in sum, the first thing you need to have, as I've mentioned before, is a realistic cash flow projection. You know, consult with your advisors, look at other options, really drill down on this. This is going to be your survival line.
And typically you have to do that on a weekly basis. You need to find out when your cash flow hole is going to be, because your employees are not going to take, you know, IOUs for compensation.
And that's one of the more critical aspects, is dealing with your employees is one of the easiest ways to get yourself in trouble. You have to make payroll. You have to make your tax withholdings. You can have personal liability for either, and you just don't want to be there. Employees have priority claims in most cases. Uncle Sam has priority claims. That can easily derail your entire program. So make sure, above all, that you're not, don't go to the temptation of trying to borrow from the tax fund, your tax withholding funds. Don't miss payroll. Related to that, don't panic and lay off people without making plans and without setting aside the funds to pay the accruals that come due at that point. In general, be very careful in that area. I mean, go ahead, Dean.
Yeah, and on the when you lay people off, it actually accelerates the obligation to pay people, because you have to pay them their accrued vacation. And if you don't give people their final paycheck in California, you can be charged up to 30 days of further compensation. If you're 4 days late paying someone, you owe them 4 more days of pay.
And there are plenty of plaintiff's employment lawyers out there who know that law and are aggressive about it, and they generally get what they ask for.
And unlike other areas of law, there are two places where the law works very quickly. One is landlord-tenant, and the other is essentially going to the wage commissioner and collecting your overdue wages.
So to sum up here, know what you're doing, know what your cash flow obligations are, have alternative plans in place. If you can't do that, there's probably not a viable business here. This is a warning sign that maybe you ought to be looking for liquidation, not more time.
And there, I think it's very important, particularly for those who dwell on the upside, that on the downside, if you cannot pay for it or finance it until it generates revenue, it is not a business.
So joining conference.
In the situation where you don't have enough money to turn it into a viable revenue-generating business, it's not a business, and you need to stop spending money on it until you have the ability to get to there. So let's talk about the option of going virtual or dormant. And it turns out this is actually much more difficult in practice, even for a technology company or an IP-driven company, than you would expect. One thing that you can do is coordinate leaves and vacations as an alternative to layoffs. So if you're waiting, you're hoping to close a sale of the business, or you're hoping to close a funding round, and there's not enough money to pay people, you can actually say, look, we're going to have everybody take their accrued vacations, and then they're taking their vacations, they're getting paid normally for that, instead of, you know, laying them off and having to pay them for all of their accrued vacations that day. The SPOR model is really a biological sort of paradigm for surviving in difficult times. A SPOR essentially goes dormant for a long period of time. It has almost no activity, and as such, it can survive in incredibly harsh environments for decades. And then when the environment changes to be conducive to growth, it goes back to expansion and changes its form. And that's the model for the virtual company or the dormant company. It turns out that is actually much more difficult than you would expect. While you can start a company as a virtual company while you're getting it off the ground, once you've gotten to a certain size and critical mass and overhead, it is very difficult to shrink down and maintain that as sort of a credible, viable company that can grow in the future. It often fails because you don't have credibility with funding sources, potential customers, strategic partners. Oftentimes, because you're shrinking down from a larger organization, you already have overhead. You've got a lease that sort of matched the larger organization. You have a capital structure and debt so that you have existing investors that have to be repaid back with a liquidation preference, which complicates your ability to raise money in the future. And then there's a critical mass issue. You know, you have to have a certain size and throw weight in order to succeed in some areas. And then finally, in any area which is built upon technology or intellectual property, there's often a rapid depreciation, both because you can't keep the technology cutting edge and you can't keep the software at cutting edge, but also just because of the perception that, you know, that's old news, that was sort of aimed at a market 2 years ago, everything's moved on. There is a version of this, however, that does work, which is to the extent that you've got a business within this operation that is cash flowing, that is existing, that is a nice business, even if it is not sort of a take over the world and dominate a large niche business, you can shrink to fit that existing sub-business and sort of stay in operation while
joining conference.
How to get to a better day. There is a specific IP alternative to that, which I call the troll-like zombie company. And many of you may have dealt with these patent funds that are in the business of acquiring patents or funding patent litigation. The less than favorable word for those kinds of litigation trusts is a troll. What some of them do is they provide funding for an operating company because they understand that from a litigation perspective, they are much better off with a plaintiff that is actually an operating company. So they will come in, they will acquire the rights to sue to enforce the patents of your company, and they will provide enough funding to kind of keep the company on life support. Their goal is actually to have an operating company that would be the plaintiff suing, and to keep engineers on the payroll who could deal with sort of the issues that would come up in patent litigation. That is actually one potential opportunity for companies that are an absolute extremis, but it has its own issues. It's important to talk about cost cutting and realism versus perception. In my experience, the biggest problem that most companies face when they don't have enough money is that they don't react quickly enough and forcefully enough to actually cut their costs and let their people go. And that is difficult in the technology area. It is difficult in every area. People do not like firing their friends. They do not like firing the folks that have helped them all this way, and they especially don't like doing that in a difficult environment for people to get new jobs. But most companies in crisis delay cost-cutting measures for too long. That is especially true for IP-driven and technology companies because of the fear that key employees will bolt. And to use one sort of extreme example, a computer game developer, you know, basically if you talk to those folks, they the basic paradigm of that business is that you have artists and programmers who understand nothing about business and don't trust suits. And if you even hint that the company's in financial trouble, all of them have had three or four companies shot out from under them and miss payroll. So at the first whiff of danger, all of them immediately go down the peninsula and get a job at EA or Activision or somewhere else. For most companies, however, honesty and early action is a better choice. You just, for the most part, your employees actually know that there's an issue. People in early stage companies are very attuned to where are we with the next funding round and how much money do we have left and, you know, how come we don't have a signed contract with the big customer number two. So you're better off with honesty and early action. And then you need...
If I could interrupt, what would an example of that conversation be like? How would you roll out that kind of communication?
Well, I think you basically do it in a positive manner, and you say, this is what we're trying to do, and here is what our cash flow is, and here's how we're going to manage to kind of get to the next event, and here are what the plan A and the plan B and the plan C are. But in order to get the maximum runway to increase the value for all of you, we're going to have to cut costs, and here's sort of interim cost-cutting plan number one, and here's what we're going to do to make sure that we can get to the end of the runway. So you share that strategy, and then you manage toward an end game. You know, the worst sin in business is not that you had to lay off key employees or that you had to let your friends go. The worst sin in business is not making payroll and not having a company at all.
Let's assume that you have found a way to keep going and have identified a new source of capital. Let's talk about last money in financing. What differentiates last money in financing is that typically it doesn't care what the existing capital structure is at some level. It's coming into what it already knows is an existing risky situation, and it will insist on being the first money out. And this is often a difficult discussion with some of your existing financing sources. They have a contract, they're stamping on it, and it's very difficult for them, both as a strategic and simply as a realism matter, to recognize what's really going on here and what has to happen.
But it is the absolute rule of sort of the environment when there's not enough money and there are not other financing sources that last money in is first money out and gets to dictate the terms if it's the only money there is.
Yeah, it doesn't. You can stomp your feet all you want, doesn't matter. So that is just simply the environment you're playing with. Some of the different structures that you can find here is the down round, you know, where simply your money is coming in at a lower valuation. Typically, it is a more sophisticated structure, a squeeze down round, where existing investors are also going to be significantly diluted in connection with that financing. And typically, you're going to provide them with an opportunity to participate or face that dilution. So it's sort of like, you know, pay to play, you know, put up or shut up.
And that can be extreme dilution. So those who put up the new money for the final financing to sort of salvage something and find a buyer for the company essentially own almost all of it. And the pre-existing investors, notwithstanding that they have put in $50 million, get almost nothing
if they don't play
in that final round.
So again, history kind of doesn't matter there. You could have a loan to own. That is a bridge loan made by a party who is perfectly happy to become a lender, but also perfectly happy to become an owner. And you're typically going to see some fairly aggressive terms on that will allow for the takeover of the company. You could have, this is quite common, you may be negotiating a deal with a potential acquirer, and you can get a bridge loan from that acquirer. They are highly motivated, typically, to give you some money to keep going, but they will also be looking for an advantage in connection with the expected acquisition. So the cost of this could be non-trivial.
And there's really two separate models for that. But, you know, the one is, look, if this applies both to the loan to own and the bridge loan from an acquirer. One is, look, I'm just giving you 60 days or whatever the right number of days is. And we're going to be excruciatingly clear on the front end that you need to go find someone else within this period of time. And if you don't, I will simply foreclose on the assets. And that's the deal. And that's explained. And I don't want to hear later on you're complaining that what I did was essentially enter into this loan to acquire all the assets, because I am. I'm doing that explicitly. And if you don't go find another buyer, then I will own the assets for this, and I'm just giving you one chance to do that, and we all know that up front. The other is, look, you know, the bridge loan from an acquirer, where obviously you don't want to sell the company for just the bridge loan. So oftentimes you get a much longer runway to repay that loan back, And the idea is, look, you know, we want to close this deal with you, and if we don't close this deal with you, then your money is going to sit here, but if we close a deal with someone else, then we'll pay your money back. And it's essentially a secured option.
But what one thing to be aware of here, particularly if you're on the company side, is you need to listen carefully to what's going on here. Dean just explained a transaction in which people were excruciatingly clear up front about what their motives are and what's going on. But all too often, I see cases where people are hearing, "I'm going to give you a bridge loan," of course I'll be secured, or you know, "I'm going to give you a bridge loan, and of course we'll do an acquisition deal later on." They are focused on the money coming in, not the restrictions, not the dangers, not the exposure that comes with it, and they do not you don't necessarily fully appreciate the fact that you are handing over the keys at that point. And control over your future at the point in which you get the bridge loan, not the later point, but at that point, and you need to focus on the details of the transaction and what your exposure are very carefully.
And you know, some people are very difficult to educate about this, you know, that they are founders, they are inventors, they are computer game developers, they are lots and lots of different people who really think, well, it's unfair if you take my whole company just for this amount of this loan that's secured by all of the assets. That can't be right. I raised all of this money at a valuation, and I'm supposed to go to an IPO and have $200 million, and you can't take it for just that last $1.8 million that was to keep me alive, and that's not fair. Well, life isn't fair, and you really need to be excruciatingly clear up front when that loan comes in that that is how it works. That we talked earlier about the, you know, the patent pool financing, and then there is one sort of the earmarked loan to pay certain debts. Sometimes there are companies that have gotten themselves into trouble. You know, there are going to be issues about unpaid payroll, and there are going to be issues about unpaid withholding taxes or trust fund taxes, or there is a guarantee on the lease, or there is some sort of issue where someone is on the hook for some obligation of the company. Oftentimes, at the very end of the day, you can get an earmarked loan from those individuals or those financial sources to say, look, we'll take care of this one sort of liability, but that's where the money has to go, and we will insist that it gets paid directly there. Let's talk about sort of the restart and wind-up problems, and I think it's first helpful to start with kind of what are the problems you have to solve in order to have an effective restart, and then figure out how you solve those problems. And they're very practical, which are typically your informed realistic buyers are the existing employees, management, founders, board members, or investors. So essentially, the only people who would relaunch this or buy it or, you know, restart it are the people who are effectively insiders. And how do you avoid a conflict of interest, misappropriation of corporate opportunity, breach of fiduciary duty, or fraudulent transfer liability in a deal among insiders? I mean, if you're transferring the assets to your management team or to your controlling investor or to your founder or to your employees or any subset of those, how can these people who are sitting on both sides of the transaction work out something that's going to be perceived as fair? And this is particularly important because the whole goal of a restart or relaunch is to make this thing fabulously successful in the future, free of the old debts, free of the old capital structure, and all you've done is simply sort of painted a bullseye on your back and said, if we're successful, please do come sue us so you get your share. That having been said, without some kind of relaunch or transfer free of the old debt or the old capital structure, no one would put up new funds. No one would put up new efforts to make this company successful. It simply cannot succeed in its current form with its current capital structure, with its current debts, and its current business model, and it's not going to work. So you do have to solve these problems. Fortunately, there are a way to solve some of the problems, but one of the thorny ones is the fraudulent transfer issue. Matt, why don't you orient us about that?
Sure. This Dean's already mentioned this, and this is a theme that runs through a lot of the potential structures, the structuring around the possibility of fraudulent transfer. And you hear the word fraudulent transfer, and it sounds pretty dire, like you're doing something pretty nasty. And in fact, that is one aspect of it. Fraudulent transfer is really two separate concepts. One is an actual kind of fraudulent intent, And the other is what's called constructive fraudulent transfer. That is, you may have had a heart of gold, but it's done in such a situation, we're not going to worry about what your actual intent was. It looks bad, and it's prejudicial to creditors, and therefore we're going to call it a fraudulent transfer. Let's start with the actual intent to hinder, delay, or defraud creditors. A couple of things to note about that. One is the word intent. You see intent, think litigation bait. You can argue about intent all you want. It is fertile grounds for somebody to bring some sort of action to try to get something from you. And in this respect, I would say email is not your friend. All too often, you see people leave email trails that make it very easy to create an argument that there was, in fact, an intent to hinder. I'm not going to let X get hold of this asset. I'll be damned if so-and-so is going to collect against us. You've got to be real careful about creating, you know, a decent record if you're even anywhere close to this kind of situation. Constructive fraudulent transfer. That's where you have a transfer. That's either you are undertaking an obligation, or you're giving out property, you're giving out collateral for less than reasonably equivalent value, while the transferor is insolvent, inadequately capitalized, or has reason to know it's unable to pay its debts when due. Typically, this is done after the fact. And so it's pretty easy to make a case that you're unable to pay your debts when you do, or you're insolvent. The argument tends to be all over reasonably equivalent value. And again, a good record, you know, of analysis, you know, looking at anything from hiring appraisers to some sort of evidence that you went out to the market, all this builds up to help create a defense based on the fact you've got reasonably equivalent value. The issue with fraudulent transfer that you've got to be careful about is it's got a very long statute of limitations, up to 7 years in California. Any creditor whose prejudice can sue, including any trustee in a subsequent bankruptcy. You've created a target-rich environment here, and the person who gets sued is the buyer, the ones who are putting in the new money. That is, you know, the acquirer of the business or the person giving you a secured loan. And no one is going to fund a venture to pay off the existing liabilities, the existing creditors, or accept this kind of liability. So it is a problem that needs to be solved.
There are some other common problems, one of which is that management is not allowed to misappropriate a corporate opportunity, that with an existing business, new ideas may belong to the current employer by virtue of an assignment of an inventions agreement. There are limitations under California law as to what can or cannot be assigned, but the common myth of formation is always when you talk to people who've left one company and then have founded a startup, that the story is always, well, I left the old company on a Friday, I was casting about what to do, and over the weekend or the next Monday, I had gone off to Tahoe and this idea sprang into my mind whole. And I just sat down at my laptop and began typing and, you know, it came up with this brilliant new plan and technology or whatever it is. The truth is, though, a lot of times there are pre-existing memos, there's a hard drive, there are all kinds of things that the old company, that the business plan was actually put together long before that. So you have to be careful about those things. The board of a company has a fiduciary duty to the shareholders and perhaps in the zone of insolvency to creditors, although the whole zone of insolvency concept is really a Delaware law concept. California courts have been somewhat hostile to it. And the good news is for directors that kind of between limitations on liability, it's now fairly well understood both in Delaware and California that really the concept is you have a trust notion. You have to treat the corporation as a trust for the benefit of its owners and its creditors and not engage in self-dealing, and then you need to have your actions protected by the business judgment rule. In addition, secured creditors may have a perfected priority claim to some or all of the IP assets that are part of their collateral, and then there is one major issue in sorting these things out, which is that there is an almost perfect trade-off between speed versus certainty and managing toward a successful second exit strategy. That there are certain ways to sort of transfer the assets that are very fast, But those ways tend to have some more litigation risk with respect to old creditors and old shareholders who say, well, look, I don't think you dealt fairly with me. I think you violated the law. And then you have certain ways to get absolutely clear title to all of the assets.
Joining conference.
But oftentimes those ways are too slow, and so that those ways to get the assets are not practical. And then, you know, most important, if you're going to relaunch a company, you have to get the assets in such a form that you can manage toward a successful second exit strategy of going public or selling the company at that point. So you have to be able to explain to someone who hasn't ever seen acquiring assets out of a foreclosure how that works.
So if you're going to, you've survived, you're in a position where your next step is to put the assets into some sort of structure where somebody could actually get value out of them. What are the different ways, what are the different structures you can look at? We're going to talk about the most common ones, asset sales, a stock merger with a better funded company, licensing agreements, assignments for the benefit of creditors, very common in California, secured debt foreclosure, bankruptcy sales, and bankruptcy reorganization.
The simplest is an asset sale. But if you're going to sell substantially all of the assets of a corporation, you've got to get the sale approved by the shareholders. That may be difficult if there's no consideration for common shareholders that's going to come out of a deal. The consideration that's paid for assets has to first go to secured creditors who have a security interest in the collateral being sold, then to unsecured creditors because creditors are paid ahead of shareholders, then to preferred shareholders, and then to common shareholders. So if they're out of the money, why should the common shareholders agree? And then there's the issue of sort of allocating in the purchase price how much money is paid for the assets and how much is paid for non-competes and consulting agreements and in the form of options for the key team that's coming over it.
And here's one of those areas in which arguments about conflicts of interest seem to be rife.
But the truth is, everyone understands that you cannot sell people in the United States. We've got specific amendments to the U.S. Constitution that provide for that, and all you can do is give them financial incentives to come along with the deal, and often they are a key component of the value being acquired.
An alternative to selling the assets is to merge your company with its core of employees and technology with a better capitalized partner. Frequently, this is done in the form of what's sometimes called a cutout merger, which is when the consideration given, the stock consideration, is of a value such that it wipes out the common and sometimes junior preferred shareholders. As we've mentioned before, employees are a key component of the value of the company. They're frequently protected through some sort of option arrangement, you know, in NewCo when they are rehired by the merged company. So they're taking care of. The issue tends to focus around the wiped out common. This becomes an issue when you think about how the voting works. Dean mentioned the need to get votes from a common who's not going to get any benefit out of the deal. And here, the difference between a Delaware and a California corporation and really becomes an issue. I'm assuming that these are going to be the typical corporate structures you're going to be dealing with. In Delaware, the vote of a majority of all the shareholders is required. And if you've got preferred with a massive as converted base, they will tend to dominate that. California requires a majority of each class. In addition, California corporate law has this concept called the quasi-California corporation, a corporation which has certain characteristics based on that essentially cause it to be very California-like, even though it's formed under the laws of another jurisdiction. That is, it does a majority of its business, has a majority of its shareholders, payroll, revenues come from California. There's a somewhat complicated formula, will be considered to be a California corporation for certain purposes of California corporations law, including voting on mergers. So you may be in a situation where you have to pay attention to both sets of law at the same time. They're not completely congruent. And in fact, it's even more complicated by the fact that Delaware will not recognize California's quasi-corporation rights unless there's a judgment from California. So there's a race to the courthouse typically associated with all of this. So this is an area that you have to be quite careful about tiptoeing your way through. also in connection with votes. Don't forget that by contract, including the terms of any of your preferred stock issuances, people may have very specific voting rights that have to be addressed. So strategizing how you're going to corral the votes is a very important part of this, if you're going to use this particular remedy to get to the next step. You also have to deal with dissenters' rights, folks who had the right to vote who did not vote in favor of the merger, typically have the right to receive the fair value of their shares, which may or may not be congruent with what was offered in the merger. There's a tendency to kind of split the baby, so there is an incentive to go ahead and push for dissenters' rights, which can increase the cost of the share of the deal, which typically leads to acquirers in a merger requiring a supermajority vote, a very high vote in order to make the deal happen. The plus side of an appraisal is it is, particularly in California, an exclusive remedy and can cut off a lot of other green mail style litigation in these situations. Finally, I'll just mention in brief some workarounds to get around some of this complexity. If you've got one preferred investor who's got a dominating share, it tends to be easier to do these deals. If you've got a lot of little investors, it's also not particularly hard. It's where you have two or three minority investors who have enough that they're well motivated to bear the cost of bringing litigation that these deals get to be quite difficult to do. Often this can be dealt with ahead of time if someone's had the forethought by requiring drag-along rights in appropriate circumstances, forcing other classes along with their vote. You can create sweeteners, keep a little on the table for the common, so that they have a pretty good understanding that they're going to be better off if they vote for this than if they try to push for something else. And finally, one remedy I haven't seen much, but I think might be kind of useful, is to go for a California fairness hearing, if you're a California corporation, which could cut short some of this, some of the possibilities of litigation.
And one just practical sort of observation, a lot of times when I've seen these kinds of things and there was a fair amount of concern over people exercising dissenters' rights, it did not turn out to be a problem because everybody said, I'm not going to spend hard U.S. dollars chasing this thing when the common is really out of the money and I don't think there's anything there. And the short time frame to exercise it means that's not going to hang over the transaction for a long period of time, and so you can actually deal with it by sort of a small holdback, and then, you size the issue if two shareholders start making noise about exercising dissenters' rights. The technology licensing agreement for a lot of companies is an alternative to selling assets. And in connection with that, you've got to remember the barnyard rule, which is little pigs get fed, but large hogs get slaughtered. And another way to put that is don't get too cute. The same fraudulent transfer and fiduciary duty principles apply to something that's essentially a transfer of all the assets of the company, but is simply disguised as a, quote, licensing transaction, close quote. Licensing is an almost endlessly flexible tool in dividing up IP rights and economics. You can have sort of any sort of way to divide up just about intellectual property rights and abilities to exploit things, and you can have all kinds of different formulas about how to hand out the economics to the licensor. If I have a bullet point here that it may not require shareholder approval, obviously an ordinary license entered into by a company of intellectual property does not require shareholder approval, but if it is essentially simply a disguised transfer of all of the assets of the company, then, someone's going to raise the same issue. In California, there's a particularly useful tool for solving all of these problems, which is an assignment for benefit of creditor sales. Years ago, in the aftermath of the dot-com collapse, I was on a panel with a U.S. trustee from San Jose who said that they had done a study there, within the Department of Justice, and came to the conclusion that 99% of the Silicon Valley collapse dot-coms were liquidated through these assignments for benefit of creditors, not bankruptcy. And that is because they actually work. They're fast. They're practical. You bring in a true arm's-length fiduciary who actually gets the, context of troubled company, not enough money to go around, and they enter into a sale transaction where they can give good title to a buyer, even if that buyer happens to be somebody who was put together by the former shareholders or the founder or the management team or some subset of all of those. and that's the way to get the maximum value for the creditors and the shareholders. Speed is absolutely critical for most of these companies if there's anything to salvage. You can't go file a Chapter 7 bankruptcy and wait for the appointment of a trustee and figure out how you're going to deal with this and have a first meeting of creditors, because by the time you're finished with even that process, let alone a sale of the assets approved by the bankruptcy court, there's nothing to sell. All the employees have wandered away. Nobody knows where the source code is. The servers have been shut down. The power is off. The landlord has evicted you, and there's just nothing there anymore. It does, an assignment for benefit of creditors does preempt creditor attempts to attach assets, because the assignee has superior title to someone just going to get an attachment now on a contract claim. You do still need shareholder approval, because it is a transfer of substantially all of the assets to the assignee for the benefit of creditors. Sometimes that's actually possible to do in a way that you couldn't get them to approve a specific transaction to a third party for a number, because no one knows what the number is until the assignee actually finalizes a purchase and sale agreement. Secured creditors, certain priority tax, and perhaps some employee wage claims still do have priorities in an assignment for benefit of creditors. The next alternative is actually to foreclose on a loan which is secured by the key assets of the company. Matt, why don't you walk us through that?
Sure. I'm going to look at this through the perspective of the holder of the secured lien, but you can take whatever lessons you need. It's pretty obvious how this plays out for the other parties here. First of all, to state the obvious, you need a perfected security interest. This only works if, in fact, you do have a security interest, and that is sometimes more complicated than you think. The basic rule of getting a security interest is file early, file often, make sure you've got proper notices filed in all the places you need, and then it covers all the collateral you need, that is all the assets you need in order to have a working business. So, for example, you may get the computers, you may not get the IP if you're not careful. You may not get the leasehold interest that you need in order to continue operating in the same space. And above all, admit, you know, as Dean's mentioned before, people aren't property. So you could get all the hard assets and even all the IP, but if you don't have the engineers, if you don't have the sales force, if you don't have the continuation, they may not be worth much. So this is often something that you need to do in conjunction with a larger strategy, as we'll mention later. Can you buy a secure loan and foreclose? Yeah. It doesn't matter whether you buy it for pennies on the dollar. This is an alternative strategy. You could pick up the security interest that some previous lender may have put in place. They may be tired. They may be, need to liquidate their position. You've got a strategy where you can get maximum value out of these assets. This is a way. This is a loan-to-own kind of play, a secondary loan-to-own play. Secured foreclosure can take all sorts of forms. It could be a friendly foreclosure that is basically contractual. You've negotiated with all the parties. It's an easy handover with a little disruption. You can have an unfriendly foreclosure where people just sit on their hands, and it's basically up to you. You can have what we call the Winston Churchill, we will fight them on the beaches, foreclosure, where it's a scorched earth policy on behalf of the debtor or other creditors. Now, in these kind of deals, typically the secured lender holds the cards. The law is pretty much biased on their side. They've got all sorts of quick remedies that they can use in order to get control of the assets. But if people are going to deal with you fraudulently, hire assets, lock the doors, time being of the essence, this could be a problem, and again, may drive you towards a combined strategy of which foreclosure is only part of it.
Okay, we're going to pick up speed now and cover the last three slides in 2 minutes, but bankruptcy can stop a foreclosure, and the common structure is you have a foreclosure sale, and then you also, having foreclosed on all the assets and having all of the power and the rights to everything, you agree to pick up some liabilities or to pay some closing costs or to pay the employee's accrued vacation to get a quitclaim deed to all of the assets, plus a further assurances clause that if anything needs to get executed with the transferring of the URLs or the trademarks, that they'll go sign the papers. There's another alternative, which is a bankruptcy sale. You can get maximum certainty of title. A court order basically says you own it free and clear. Bankruptcy is slow. You're subject to overbids. And there are some wrinkles that make it work in some circumstances, because you can cap a landlord's damage claim. You can get assignment of some non-assignable agreements. You can eliminate creditor attachments that were levied in the 90 days before bankruptcy. The automatic stay prevents a foreclosure, and it blows out all unperfected security interests. As a practical matter, bankruptcy sometimes works. For intellectual property-driven companies, if you file bankruptcy out here in California, where the Ninth Circuit is, there are problems about assuming and assigning patent licenses and copyright licenses. One final critical issue is how to avoid liability.
Don't stiff Uncle Sam. Don't stiff your employees. Don't get too clever with the assets and create a fraudulent transfer.
Consider leaving the D&O insurance in place or buying tail insurance, and also consider just not doing that. You don't want, in some of these circumstances, the only pile of money left to be an insurance policy if it turns out people want to sue the directors and officers. Understand your WARNAC obligations. As a practical matter, most people simply say, I'm going to live with the exceptions and not, you know, notice the sale, and then put the sale together and then just take care of it as part of closing the sale. And if I don't do it, I'll just live with the, that was the only way to get the thing done. Document decisions by your board and entertain all offers. If somebody offers something for the company that pays nothing to the common shareholders, have a board meeting, fully consider that, and then turn it down, and then it's protected by the business judgment rule. If you don't entertain the offer, somebody says, well, the business judgment rule only protects you if you made a decision. You didn't even bring that to the board, and that breached the fiduciary duty to creditors or to junior shareholders or something else.
Avoid being colorful and dramatic in your record at this point. This is where you want it to be very somber.
Okay, so that is the overview and the specifics of dealing with these companies in difficult times. Now we're open for any questions anybody wants to offer on the phone.
Hi, this is Sean. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Okay, great. Hey, Dean, Sean here, kind of the poster child of all this good stuff. The one thing that I wanted to just throw out there is if you have kind of successfully turned things around and you got a little profit and you got things growing and you have a fairly substantial patent portfolio, rather than a downward scenario where you're trying to, you know, leverage the patent portfolio, what would you recommend is a good option to try and slice and dice the potential upside of approaching certain companies, and would you recommend you know, a firm or does FBM do that kind of thing?
There are a number of different strategies, and they have business, legal, economic, and sometimes even ethical complications to them. But here are some of the things that you can do. Number one, a lot of times people simply use a patent portfolio defensively, and you sort of figure out, you know, if I start going and sort of throwing around patent litigation, does that mean somebody bigger is going to try to shut me down? So that's number one issue to think about. Number two, there are actually funds out there that will fund patent litigation for a piece of the proceeds, and they can make very quick determinations about whether they're interested in your patent portfolio, whether they think there's money in it. There are firms that are law firms that essentially do this kind of thing, and there are outside funding sources that do it, and then there are, you know, some of these hybrids about all that. So there are a bunch of alternatives, and Sean, why don't you give me a call separately or shoot me an email and I can give you some contact information.
Okay, thanks, Steve.
Okay, well, just as the context of the foreclosure auction, going once, going twice, we are done with this program. We wish you all luck, and you can now go enjoy the San Francisco Giants World Series parade. Thank you all.
Thank you.